This is the afternoon session of Wednesday, October the 22. Mr. President, Dave was just asking about this incident in which you talked with President-elect Eisenhower about his not attending your 1948 inaugural. Can you give us the time and circumstance?
In 1940?
No, no, no. This 1948. He did not attend your inaugural.
1948. Well, I think he had been sent to Europe as the head of NATO at that time.
What Bill means is at the time you were escorting the president-elect to Capitol Hill, you got into a discussion about who sent for his son, and then...
Oh, that was 1952. Well, it was 53, January the 20th, 1953.
Yes, at the inauguration.
That's right, 1952. That's right.
Yes.
Well, he was invited to come to the White House and go down to the inauguration with me in the car. He didn't come to the White House. He came down by the White House and sent word in that he was ready to go. So I went out and got in the car with him. And on the way down there, we had discussions of various things. And there was one incident that has never been told, in which he made the statement that he didn't come to my inauguration in 1949 because he was sure that more than half the people would be applauding him instead of me. And I turned around to him and said, Ike, you'd have come if I'd ordered you. Don't worry about that. And that ended the conversation until we got to the Capitol building. And then we were in the room waiting to go out onto the platform in the Capitol when he said that somebody had caused his son to come to the inauguration, and he thought it was just a way to embarrass him. I said, if it is, I embarrassed you because I ordered your son to come, and he ought to be here.
Very good. Now,
why
didn't the president come in? Is it customary for a president-elect to come and call on the outgoing president?
It's customary for the president-elect to come to the White House and usually have coffee or tea or a sandwich or two, and then go down to the inauguration, which takes place at noon. But he didn't show up. We had things all ready for him, but he didn't come.
And this was the time he wore the Homburg, and you were stuck with the...
He made the statement in New York he's going to wear a Homburg hat. Well, I didn't care what he wore. So not to embarrass him, I didn't wear any hat, I don't think.
You didn't wear a cylinder hat?
No. The president should wear the most formal clothes when he's going to the inauguration. But I think this was done for popularity purposes. I didn't pay attention to it. It was all right to me if he didn't want to wear the customary dress. I was supposed to go along with him because he was very soon to be president of the United States.
What was his mood in the car?
Well, as cold as it was the other day at Marshall's funeral.
Excuse me, you go ahead. I've got just coming in.
I'll
come back to my question.
Fine. I want to ask about whether when Franklin Roosevelt was inaugurated in 33, or was it 32 then, wasn't it?
No, it was on the 4th of March, 33.
4th of March, it was way over.
March 33.
And that was before the lame duck thing was abolished.
That's right.
And did Herbert Hoover stay in the house and Roosevelt call on him, or did the same thing happen then?
No. Roosevelt went by the White House and paid him every courtesy, and they rode down together in long tails and a high hat, just like they should.
It wasn't too courteous, though. It was rather cold.
I don't know. I wasn't there. I wasn't at the inauguration.
All right. Now, we have some things to get at, and they're pretty basic things. And you have been discussing before what you would do or what you would propose for the health, housing, and education of the nation, the higher education of the nation in the future. And you've also discussed the complex and the confounding taxing problems that are beginning to pile up in the country. Now, let us switch to the Orient, because there is a apparently a developing a future trouble. But how do you view the big switch in the Orient with imperialist Japan now adopting the ways of peace and democracy, and hitherto peaceful China going military, warlike, totalitarian, and imperialist?
I think China is going through the same stage that Japan did when they assumed the same attitude. And I'm as sure as I can be that the Chinese are a very, very able people, and that they have come out of the situation just as Japan did, on the side of free government.
How do you see the aftermath of Chiang Kai-shek's passing? What will happen to nationalist China and Formosa?
Well, the only reason that Chiang Kai-shek had to move over to Formosa was because his generals surrendered to the communists and surrendered all the equipment that we'd sent him, and they used that equipment to run Chiang out of China.
Do you think that Red China should be admitted to the United Nations, and if not now, when?
I've never been in favor of admitting them, and we can't very well admit them until they have shown more interest in the welfare of their neighbors and the people by whom they are expected to set an example, as they did in times past.
Now, if nationalist China should be without a leader, it would obviously cease to be of any significance in the affairs of the United Nations or in any of the affairs of the Orient.
The only reason for the nationalist China situation is due to the fact that they were one of the five great powers who set up the United Nations. And it's very difficult to eliminate people who help make an organization. That was long before Chiang Kai-shek's general surrendered to the communists.
Well, do you think that the United States would be in a position of having to defend the integrity and the independence of Formosa, even if there were no Chiang Kai-shek about?
Formosa is a part of the defense line, which is used to draw a line against the communist world, and I think they'd have to defend it.
So you still see a divided China for quite some time until Red China mends its ways and becomes a civilized member of the United Nations.
That's true.
You think there's any hope for that?
I doubt it.
So you don't think that is here in the foreseeable future?
It's not an immediate proposition that we have to worry about, because I don't think the Chinese, under its present government, will mend its ways any more than Russia did under Stalin.
And they're on the march now, and they're going to keep going until they exhaust themselves or something stops them.
I feel that's the truth outline of the thing. That happened with the Genghis Khan. He had to march all the way to Vienna before he learned his lesson.
Now let's switch for a moment again to the domestic scene. And what do you see in store for the American farmer, particularly the family farmer?
Well, it looks as if every effort has been made in the last 6 or 7 years to eliminate the family farm and make it an industrial proposition, just as they have in Russia. I don't believe in that. I think the family farm was the foundation of the country. I think we're going to have the family farm, and I don't think there's any way in the world to completely eliminate it. Of course, now, the difficulty with the farm situation has been that the increased productivity of the soil brought about by the proper rotation of crops and fertilizers, and the improvement in the grain production, for instance, hybrid corn and wheat and oats, is much greater than it was in times past. And 1 acre will raise as much as 10 acres used to raise. So I don't know what the answer is. I hope it's good for the farmers.
You don't feel that the government of the United States could ever turn its back upon the farmer, either in terms of support or in terms of necessity brings it about subsidies of the additional subsidies to keep them going?
I think the United States government is going to have to keep the food producers in business. are to be done is a matter that ought to be worked out as scientifically as possible. I had a Brannan plan when I was president of the United States, which, in my opinion, would have eventually worked the thing out. But it was ridiculed out of existence.
Now, do you feel that they ought to cooperate a little bit more among themselves in the way that the National Farmers Union is where you brought about cooperation?
I think the National Farmers Union has done more to create a situation among the farmers to get them to help themselves than any other organization we have. The other organizations of the farmers are just organizations of capitalists who want to put the farmer out of business.
Now, how does the Department of Agriculture function? Since your administration, the budget for the operation of the department has gone up enormously.
$5 billion, gone up from $1.1 billion to about $6.4 billion.
Now, what is that money going for, sir? What are they doing to
get them? I have the slightest notion what they've done with the money, because they seem to be against the crop program which we had in force, and they had a soil bank proposition which they thought would keep the farmer from raising crops, and they paid great money to big farmers, but the little farmer didn't do any good with that sort of an arrangement. I think that's what's gone with the $5.5 billion.
Now, a good many of the farm organizations have been in sympathy with recently with the Secretary Benson, and out of sympathy with the Brannan plan.
I don't know of any farm organizations who know what they're talking about that are in sympathy with Benson.
So the farm organizations, in a large sense, are not exactly representing the best interest of the farmer in your judgment?
One or two of them are not. Some of them are.
All right. Now, how do you view the evolution of the American labor movement? What is in store for the bullying, arrogant type of labor leader like Hoffa and Bridges?
Well, I think they eventually will get their comeuppance, just like every other situation where a man gets power and gets too big for his britches. He soon has a come down, and the difficulty with the labor movement is the fact that they've been able to collect too much money in one place. And when any man, I don't care who he is, whether he's a banker or a laboring man or somebody else, when he gets control of too much money, why, it makes a fool out of him, and that's what's happened to the Teamsters Union.
Now, the labor movement had come through because of some pretty difficult battles they had on their hands in order to achieve some measure of economic security. But there's so many laws on the books now having to do with the Social Security and the underpinning of the people's economy. Is there as much need for big labor unions and the things they do that there used to be?
Yes, there is. The National Labor Relations, National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, is what put labor on its feet. And the thing, when it began to work, of course, needed amendment. But it didn't need the Taft-Hartley Act for that amendment, as they're very conclusively finding out. But the labor boys thought they had something, and they voted for it, and they got what was coming to them.
Well, how do you differentiate between Hoffa, Bridges, and John L. Lewis in terms of labor leadership?
Well, John L. Lewis was a fellow who thought he was a kind of a king, but he found out that he wasn't, and he adjusted himself to conditions. And another thing in the difference between John L. Lewis and Hoffa and Bridges, Lewis was honest and the other two weren't.
You think that Lewis fought, even though harshly and sometimes arrogantly, but he had in mind the
He was always fighting for his people, and these other people have been fighting for themselves and exploiting their people. That's the difference.
Now, what would you do with those people? How would you deal with them?
I made a recommendation in the veto messages, both of them, of the Taft-Hartley Act, on how to handle that situation, was to see that their funds are properly investigated and that they have to make reports at certain times on what they do with the money and why they do it, and that the dues of the members should be on a basis where it would accomplish the purposes for which the union was set up without creating a great fund for exploitation of the heads of the union. That's the difference.
Well, in that case, what do you think of unions spending or contributing money to a political campaign?
Well, I think it's all right because they've done it for me.
But you've covered that in a previous interview,
right,
that you didn't think they could appropriate union funds. They could collect funds, but not treasury funds.
Not treasury funds. It's not treasury funds they should appropriate. I remember when the railroad unions in 1940, they collected a dollar apiece for $8,800, and that's all the money I had to run the campaign with, but they didn't take it out of the treasury. And they shouldn't take it out of the treasury. That's not the point.
Mr. President, I have with me here a match holder showing you and Richard M. Nixon linked arm in arm. And it's called The Harry S. Truman and Richard M. Nixon Buried Their Hatches in the Steinway, Official State Piano. As the National Press Club All-Star Musicale in Washington, Missouri Waltz by Mr. Nixon and California Here I Come by Mr. Truman. Dual duet medley.
It didn't happen.
It did not happen.
Never did happen.
How is this?
That picture was made when Nixon met me on my first visit back to Washington to escort me into the Senate for the purpose of occupying my seat and making a speech in the Senate. That was in 1953, shortly after the Republicans went in. But no such thing as a televote on that mess thing took place.
Well, Mr. President, what I want to get to is your return to the Senate on during the time that you've been out of office. On this occasion, the Vice
this
President...
This was the first time that I was there to make a speech to the press club. And I had lunch down in the basement of the, over at the, well, it's over in the Senate dining room.
Yes.
And they asked me to come up to the Senate. And that was the first time I was there. The next time I was there was after 1954, when Nixon had called me a traitor, and I wasn't going to the Senate after that, unless he got out of the chair, and they finally put Barkley in the chair, and then I went in. That was the second visit.
And
but no such deal as that ever took place.
That was the second visit. Then you have made one or two other visits since then, haven't you?
Oh, yes, I've made several visits since then.
But Nixon was never in the
chair.
Never
in the chair when I went in.
Was that, did he realize that? Was that by prearrangement or
if
how?
If he didn't realize that, I wouldn't have gone in.
In other words, that the only way that you could have possibly buried the hatchet with Mr. Nixon was to have it buried in his back.
Well, no, if he'd gone on after that meeting, as he should have, and hadn't gone down and around over the country and called me a traitor, I wouldn't have had any feeling against him. I didn't care what he said in the campaign in 1952. It was in 54 in the congressional election when he got so bitter and so mean, just as he did against Helen Keg and Douglas and his opposition when he was running for
Jerry Voorhees.
Yeah. Jerry Voorhees.
Could I get back to the strike business, or do you have a thing about Nixon?
No, I just want to get there while we're on the Senate thing. I wanted to. Do you recall any memorable discussions with any senators during the time you returned to the Senate since you've been out of the White House, Mr. President?
Well, no. I've had several meetings with Senate committees, and that was all a matter of record on the various subjects, the United Nations and things of that sort. And I appeared before the House Committee on the appropriations for NATO and the Point 4 program. I spent an hour or two with that committee, and the whole committee was present, and they all had a chance to ask questions. And the Republicans had prepared what they thought was a very embarrassing program for me, and I think I converted all of them. They became as polite as they possibly could be.
You were also asked to testify on the question of this two-term limitation of the president.
That's right. That's right.
As I recall, on one occasion, Mr. President, when just before Senator Taft died, when he was still hobbling about, you had quite a warm meeting with him on the
Senate. Floor of the Senate. He was on crutches and standing there, and I went over and spoke to him, and one of the Republican senators from Kansas was there, and they said that Harry and I have always had a viewpoint that he'd make the best Democratic candidate, and I'd make the best Republican candidate for the reasons we think the other could be easier to defeat.
Do you recall any other incident with any other senator at all in that nature or anecdotal?
No, I don't. When I went into the Senate after the meeting when Barker was in the chair, well, the senator from South Carolina walked out the other door as I came into one, but I thought that was all right.
Oh, yes. Have you had any difficulty with any of the so-called Dixiecrats since that time?
No, I haven't had any trouble with any senator. Never had any trouble with any senator.
Well, along that line, if Senator Taft had been nominated and elected president in 52, would he have been the same, in your opinion, would he have carried on a program of conservatism and withdrawal, or would he have gone along with the established policy?
Oh, no, I think he would have carried on a program of conservatism, but he would have been as decent and nice to his predecessor as a man could be, because he and I were personal friends on the floor of the Senate. You don't have to fall out of a man because you don't agree with him on policy.
But you do feel that he would have changed the policy materially.
He would have gone as far right as that Congress would let him.
Well, in that respect, we had a narrow escape, probably. Now, Mr. President, getting back to the, not the right to strike, but the sanity or the wisdom of striking under our present setup, we're now going through the 100 day of a steel stoppage. You've had some experience with that kind of thing. What is your opinion with respect to these strikes in on a vast scale in view of our importance in the world today, the free world, as a going and expanding economy?
Well, it's not a good thing when a nationwide strike takes place, and there ought to be some way to stop it and force negotiation. I followed through on a program of that kind, and the steel fellows, who are now in trouble, took the matter to the courts, and there was a decision by the court, 3-6, 6-3, and the minority report, a minority opinion, should be the law today. There of those six opinions, there were seven altogether. Justice Frankfurter had to write two, and none of them had any sense. But they called it a majority against what I was trying to do, which was to prevent just what's happened in the last 100 days. And I think even the steel people are kind of sorry now that they went to the court with that sort of an approach. If you read the minority report on that case, written by Mr. Justice Vinson, who was the Chief Justice, you find out exactly what the law ought to be, and someday it will be just that.
In other words, Mr. President, you feel that some sort of compulsory arbitration should be necessary in a strike
which is nationwide, of course, for the simple reason that industry is controlled to some extent by the laws of the antitrust laws, and the other manipulation of the market is controlled by the Securities and Exchange Commission. That is, when you have a Securities and Exchange Commission that tries to enforce the law, which we haven't had for some time. That's the difference. And I wanted the powerful labor unions to be under the same sort of control as those two ideas confront industry. And if that could be done, then they'd all be treated just alike. And the little unions would have the same right before the union court as do the little people who want to sell stock.
Well, now, forced arbitration is exactly what the unions don't want. They've been fighting that thing very bitterly.
I don't care anything about forced arbitration. All I want to do is to have the government in a position to make the country run when somebody tries to stop it. And that's what I did all the time while I was president.
Now, today, the government, in arguing its case in Philadelphia on appeal from the union, argues that the government has a right to confiscate a steel company that it deems necessary to the operations of our security program, our defense program.
That's correct.
Now,
that's correct.
Well, isn't that what you tried to do?
Exactly. That was the program. I hope everybody will read Mr. Justice Vinson's minority report on the suit that was brought against me by the steel companies. I think they wish they'd never brought that suit.
Well, then you think that the strike as a weapon by the union is outdated as far as achieving the results they're concerned?
No, I don't think so. I think the strike is a necessary thing, but when it becomes to be national in scope, for instance, when they can tie up all the railroads, when they can tie up all the shipping things, when they can tie up all the steel that's necessary to keep the country running, then it's gone too far.
You've been pretty consistent on that because, as I recall, during the time of the railroad strike, you were ready to move in too.
I did move in, and then they quit.
Now, this is on the right to strike business.
Mm-hmm.
You made your point very clear on that. Can we go back over into the foreign field? And do you view the future of Germany as a force for peace, or is she likely to revert to her former ways?
Well, Germany continues to have a government as the one we have under Chancellor Adenauer. I think Germany will be a force for peace. I think Germany's had two lessons on the subject, and I think Germany's very anxious to have peace. And I think if Germany and France and the NATO countries keep up their attitude toward trade between themselves on the basis of one country, there'll never be any cause for any disturbance.
And you don't see any danger emanating from East Germany or a possibility of it merging permanently with Russia?
Yes, there is a very great danger in connection with that, if some demagogue should come along and succeed Adenauer and decide that Germany ought to be reunited and do what Hitler did, we'd have the same thing over again. I hope that won't happen. I hope the Russians will wake up to the fact that the next time Germany decides to invade Russia, nobody's going to stop them.
Historically, all three, Bismarck, Kaiser Wilhelm, and Hitler, got into power and did all their mischief with war in the process of reuniting German countries.
That's absolutely correct.
So the historical process may very well be repeated.
Could be repeated if people are not careful.
You don't see any chance that Western Germany might ever unite with Russia in any kind of an association?
Not unless they had a demagogue in control who wanted to do what Hitler and Stalin did. They united, but didn't stay united.
Well, Germany, historically, again, is easily led and easily misled.
Well, I think two lessons maybe will be enough. I hope they won't have to have a third.
Well, what does the United States do, having had two involvements in the thing, to prevent it before it gets out of hand like the last two things? Certainly the second one got out of hand.
Stay strong and keep the United Nations going in a manner that the police force of the United Nations can prevent any such thing taking place.
You have frequently talked, especially in the last few months, about the possibility of the Russian people eventually awakening and getting
When they get educated enough and understand what goes on west of their western line, nothing can hold them down.
Mr. President, I want to get back to this question of the Russian people. You feel that in time they can't escape the inevitable progress which comes to people, and that is to seek democracy or to seek...
I'm only thinking about the French and the British and the American people. They've all been through that stage, and they all came out all right. And I think eventually when the Russians find out what liberty means, individual liberty, that they'll do just what the rest of us have done. They've never had any freedom but since the time of Ivan the Terrible. They don't know what it's like. And so as long as these Communist Party people can ride them in a dictatorship, make them believe they're getting something, why, that long will they stay in slavery.
You think then that in that sense, colonialism is passing out as a form of imperialism, but is there not another form, a more subtle form of colonialism shaping up at the present time?
Well, it's a dictatorship that you're talking about. You see, colonialism was brought about by the opening of the wild countries of the world in Africa and South America and North America, And when those countries were properly opened up and the exploitation began, the people just wouldn't stand for it. But it'll take the Russians some time to come to the conclusion that they want something better than what they have. That's the difference.
Now, Mr. President, we are often being asked how we square with our freedom of government and respect for the freedom of others and encouragement when we make deals with a government like Franco's in Spain.
I never was for it. I never liked Franco, I don't like him now, and I never will like him. He's the same kind of a dictator as Hitler and Mussolini were.
Well, still, you had to deal with him.
I didn't deal with him at all. He was recognized, but we never made any deals with him at all because I didn't like him a bit. The deals have all been made since I left the White House.
But they've got a great big lot of fortifications there. Were these initiated during your period?
They were initiated immediately after I went out of office.
You would not have approved of them?
I never approved of them. I never did approve of them.
And
I don't like him, and I still don't like him.